You know how when you were a kid, you just like knew numbers?
I knew my home phone number because we sang it on our message machine, which is not unlike what Mike is doing here, because what Mike does is turn your phone number into a catchy little ditty for your kid so that they'll be able to memorize it. You go to myphonenumbersong.com, you put in a phone number, you choose whose number it is. Is it mom's? Is it dad's? Is it grandma's? Is it Quinn's? Is it Carrie's? And seconds later, what happens, Carrie?
Seconds later, you get a custom song that you can teach your kids so they can memorize your phone number. It's pretty incredible. One of the coolest parts about this is it's only $2 a song, which is insane. And also, 10% of the sales go to missingkids.org. This is amazing. And I just want to say, this is not AI, folks. He records it himself, and he has sang over 1,600 digits.
We cannot recommend it enough.
God, I can't wait to show up at a bar and be like, oh, you want my number? Let's see if you can memorize this song. Who says it needs to be just for kids? I don't have a kid, and I'm totally going to spend $2 to get my phone number in a song.
Worth it.
Totally. Go to myphonenumbersong.com and get your little song today.
Obvious.
Quinn. Hi.
Care Bear.
Quinn, it's been a month. It's been a month for us. For our listeners, it's been a damn week. But for us, it's been a month.
A week. Isn't that weird? They're like, why are you guys being so weird?
Why are you being so weird? We're being weird. This is weird. I feel weird.
Look at this zit.
Oh, mazel. Mazel to you. What's going on? Are you feeling stressed?
Yes.
Okay, lay it on me. Talk to me. Talk to me.
My family has suffered so many hardships, the worst being your absence, of course.
Thank you. Hey, thank you for bringing me back into it. But let's actually get into the real drama because I don't, you have children. I don't. So my baby is my show right now. And we talk about that later. Talk to me about your actual children.
Well, we spent all day at the emergency room yesterday for Griff because he has a lymph node infection, but I couldn't tell what was wrong with him. Like, he has a cold, but then he woke up and he couldn't move his head. And he was, like, not able to turn his head to look at me.
No.
And he wouldn't get out of bed. And then when he did, he was playing in this weird way where he was happy. So I was like, he's okay. But, like, why can't he turn his neck? And then we took him in and we took him to an urgent care. And the guy was like, I can call you an ambulance. And we were like, what? And he was like,
Wait, that's so scary.
You should go to the emergency room. And we were like, well, we will. And he's like, so you're going to drive? And we're like, yeah. And I felt like he didn't believe us. Like, he was like, should I get an ambulance? And we were like, we're going to go. Relax. We just have to get them.
When a doctor is like, should I get an ambulance? The thing is what people don't realize is like.
And I was like, they're going to need an ambulance if they don't eat. So, yes, we're going to go. But
also,
let the kids eat a bagel.
If we get an ambulance, I won't be able to feed them in the future. It's so fucking expensive to get an ambulance. Like, I guess for kids, maybe they'll
a
cab.
I would never say yes to an ambulance.
I know. I got in a bike accident one time and they were like, I didn't cry until they were like, we need to call an ambulance. And I was like, please don't. I can't afford it. That's when I started crying when I got hit by a car.
No.
Yay, Americans healthcare system. Yay.
It was wild.
Okay, wait. So he's an infected lymph node?
The whole day there.
Ugh.
Yeah, so he has like a ball of lymph nodes on the side of his neck that's like infected and it's just like really swollen and he can't move his neck. But Griff is like a really intense person. So like when Ko is sick or something, he just kind of like whimpers and like lies on the couch and is like sad and sick. Griff will like grab me, make eye contact and scream in my face, you have to fix this now. And I'll be like, I can't. And he'll be like, Mama, you fix this now.
Well,
you make me feel better right now. And I'll be like, I can't. And he'll be like crying, screaming in my face.
Oh my God. He is like the evil coach. He's like Whiplash. I feel like that.
So my heart is like, I'm already anxious. Obviously my kid's sick, but then like my heart is like pounding a mile a minute and it's like the middle of the night. And I'm like, Griff, I can't, I'm really trying.
That's so sad, because I know, like, so do you remember as intense. A kid thinking your parents could just fix everything? That is, yes, like, a really shitty lesson.
He thinks that we can, yeah. And it's heartbreaking, because he's learning it earlier than most.
No, I'm really sorry. Is he feeling better today?
That was, no, but, like, he's a little bit. I would say, like, he's on medication right now. He's on two different antibiotics, we're just alternating between Tylenol and Advil, which I have to say, though, he is, like, playing really well. And he got to stay home from school anyway because his school is closed this week because of lice.
Oh, Quinn, as if it didn't get any fucking worse. Is he itchy?
No, we already had it.
Wait, you had lice?
We were flying back home from, all of us. Not all of us. Me and Koa.
We were coming back from California?
And Koa was lying in my lap at the airport, and I saw one, and I was like, I know what that is. And then I started looking through his hair, and I was like, Koa has lice.
No, and then I had to text both my sisters and be like,
goodbye. Oh, yeah. So next time you fly, think of me and think of my family. They don't jump.
How do you get them if they don't jump?
Your head has to rub against somebody else's head.
How did
literally
Koa
your
get
hair
them?
Has to be touching someone else's? Because he had an outbreak at his school too.
Wait, and so you're saying that he kids got it
his age?
Wait. He got it from school?
Oh, I think he had it for like weeks, and we didn't know. I think he had it for weeks and weeks. Like, and I was sleeping with him in California, so I got it. And then we've now done 3 treatments.
Quinn,
per family member.
I'm sorry.
Because we so badly don't want to have it.
Thank you for waiting to tell me this.
After the first treatment, but we just keep doing treatments because we're like, if anything itches any of us, we're like, let's do another treatment. Treat everybody's hair again.
Do you throw mayo on there? Do you do like the chemical one?
No, there's this thing. No, it's actually, it's called Lice Free. It's got like a lot of extra ease in it. Lice Free.
Quinn,
because that's how you feel when you have lice.
The fucking updates I am getting from you right now, I don't know if you guys know about this, but it feels like breaking news. It feels like I don't think we're gonna have any time to talk about me. I have so many questions. This feels like a true crime. You think he's had it for weeks. Poor little Koa. Yes. You just thought he was like really inquisitive, scratching his head because he didn't know the answer to something. Little do you know, there were little fucking critters jumping around. Did anyone else get it?
No, it's not that contagious, honestly.
I think I live in fear of it because, like, I've never had it.
You have to have your
That's
head.
The thing is, once you get
kids
it, you're
pass
fine.
It to each other and kids pass it to each other a lot, because the way kids hang out is they actually like weirdly rub heads a lot.
Well, imagine like you're looking
weird.
At the same thing and you like kind of nuzzle in and you like get in there. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That makes total sense to me.
And they
wrestle
during recess. They're like lying on each other and stuff. It's like adults don't pass it to each other because we're just not in physical contact in that way.
That is, I think I do get the fear of lice and the fear of bed bugs confused, if I'm being honest.
New Yorkers do. And when I started reading about lice, I was like, oh, they're fucking idiots. Like, they can't stay alive to save their life. Excuse the expression. I was like, okay, example, they can't stand to be in a different temperature other than the temperature of your head for more than 5 minutes or they die. So if they get too cold or too hot, they die. If you,
Quinn, you committed so
put
many
your
murders
brush in boiling water, you can put a brush in boiling water for 10 minutes. Anything on it will die. You can put essential oil on your head. They will die.
Quinn,
there's a bunch of different things where it's like, it's just so hard for them to be alive. Oh, they have to be on your head eating. If they're not eating off you for 24 hours, they die. So, for instance, if you have lice and you're like wearing a hat, but then you throw your hat in a cupboard and there's a lice on it and you don't wear it in the next 24 hours, the lice will die. Like, they just are bad at living.
Wow. Well, they're great at living on Koa's head for weeks, I gotta say. Mazel to them.
Well, no one was doing anything about it. No one was recognizing so that it was a problem
idiots.
Until
as much
he was
as they're
lying
idiots,
in my lap.
They survive water. They survive shampoo.
They're good at being small. That's right.
They're good at being
well,
small.
Well, supposedly. I think that that's, well, who knows?
Wait, what other that's ailments did your thing, children but... have? Tell me more.
Koa got sick and we had to delay Disney, but like everything, we're all okay. We did go to Disney.
Yeah,
we just
I'm dying
went a
to hear
late.
About
it.
I mean, well, okay, wait, there's a couple things. Are. One, people don't realize this, but obviously it's been a month since we've hung out, but I have to tell you, the last episode, you talk about how Griffin is sick and had the norovirus.
Oh, it's my whole
life.
Last few months. It's somebody in the house is always very sick with something.
You know what? That
and I'm
feels
like
the most real. I bet every parent in here is just like nodding, being like, I know you. I feel you. Mm-hmm. I am you.
And you can't complain that much. Like, especially it was like.
You can complain to me. You yourself, can always complain to me.
But if you feel sorry for yourself, go to the pediatric emergency room because then you don't feel sorry for yourself.
Those poor
You're
babies.
Like, everyone is here for legitimately a better reason than we are. And Griff got to get a sonogram, which he loved getting. So,
wait, because they like put a little beep beep, and mm-hmm. they did a little little Griff dog. Yeah.
And he goes that his new conversation starter with people he doesn't know that well is, "Hey, remember colors?" Solid. Hey,
you know what?
Remember
love,
colors?
I love awkward interactions starting with a 3-year-old. I really love that. I think it's really
I'm
going to
start using it.
Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you start using it? Hey, have you heard about colors?
So, let's list them. Let's list the ones we know.
Have you heard? I would love to integrate for him like a little Roy G. Biv. You know what I mean? I think that would be
good. It might make him angry.
It might make him angry. You never know with
him.
He
has a lot of anger around the subject of colors, it turns out.
Wait, so
too,
he
so.
Wait, oh god, we got to teach him how to be a better conversationalist, because the idea of entering, it's like me being like, do you want to talk about women's healthcare? Starting a conversation.
Yes. Like, do you want to see me mad?
Do you want to see me mad? Hi. Yeah. It's so nice to meet you. Can I introduce you to the part of me that I'm just gonna rage out real hard, which is interesting because I do that in my show, so that's fun. I keep it tight, keep it light, keep it tight.
How's the show?
The show's going really well. Oh my God, I do have to tell you. So I've been in the UK for a month now, which feels crazy. Mm-hmm. The audiences are really enjoying the show. It's been super duper fun. Obviously, I would love for more people to come to the show. I would love to sell more tickets, but the people that are coming are the people that are supposed to come. So that feels really good. The other thing I have to tell you about is we got two horrible reviews. It was devastating. They were written by two men who just hated the idea of comedy and a parody show. You know what? I don't know if I want to keep this. I'm going to have to send
God.
It to you. It was horrible. It was it didn't feel good. I'm going to tell you right now, bad reviews, they don't feel good. They don't feel good. This is also we got.
I can't believe.
I know. It's such a bummer. I mean, this is also we got like a bunch of 5-star reviews. We got like multiple 5-star reviews.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got these two reviews.
Somehow the mean ones are always
louder
somehow in your head.
They're always louder. And one of the reviews just was like, it said actually like a lot of nice things about us, but it basically was like, he was like, I wish they had more personal details. I'm like, did you want a stand-up show? Like, I didn't know. It just feels like the person who saw the show didn't know what the show was or didn't know what we were trying to do. But again, like, it's one of those things that it's hard to deny when we do the show and people have so much fun and laugh so hard. Like it's been like people are coming back and seeing the show in different cities. So like, I know the show is connecting uh-huh. with its people, which feels really incredible. It's really fun to do the 2-act version. It's really funny to do our meet cute stories, which we invite the audience to write down their meet cutes. And I just have to tell you a couple because they're really good. Okay. One of them was we were in London and someone wrote on a note card for us to read was, I met my husband at my sister's wedding. He was the uh-huh. groom. I was the bridesmaid.
No.
Yes. That was one.
That seems
incredible.
Really
incredible.
Exciting.
Okay. There's two more that I got to share with you. The second one was, I went on a date with a guy I met online and he looked really familiar. And I finally realized I'm a criminal lawyer and I was charging him for stalking his ex. So imagine being on a date with a guy and being like, he looks so familiar. Like, he's what?
A prosecutor.
Yeah, she's a prosecutor. She was like, I was trying to get this guy in jail and I ended up going on a date with him accidentally.
I really like that.
So good.
Seems really...
There was another one that I'll share with you because I just really love them. And they're so like, so we read them on stage and it's live and fun. And you're like, what the fuck is happening? This is incredible. One of them was I started sleeping with a married mechanic from downstairs, from the garage downstairs. And when that didn't work out because he was married, I started sleeping with his son.
Oh, my God. These people, these audience members, the UK.
So every time, listen, every time we record, I'll tell you another meet cute when it comes to my mind, because it's really fucking incredible. They're so good. They're so fun. So it's like, that's really fun. We've been improvising a lot of chick flicks, a lot of The Holiday, a lot of Bridget Jones' Diary, just practicing my accent and being horribly offensive to the entire United Kingdom, which is just fun. Yes. Which is just fun. No, but it's been great. People are really enjoying the show. I'm loving performing it. It's been so fun. I am so tired. You know, we're traveling quite a lot. And I will say tomorrow, I'm going to the spa, baby.
You are.
I am. I'm treating, KK and I are treating ourselves to a spa day, and I'm really looking forward to
it. You guys deserve it.
Someone's going to touch my feet, and I can't wait. I feel like someone's going to touch a foot. I'll be out. I'm done. It's been great.
How many more shows do you have? Do you know?
Oh, my God.
If I say that? Or
I have not been counting. We have 2 more months of shows. So I would say, like, on average, it's like 5 shows a week, maybe, for 2 months. Mm-hmm. So that's 40. 8 weeks times 5 is 40.
That's so crazy.
Isn't that wild? Isn't that crazy? Maybe it's a little less.
It's going to be weird when it's done because you'll like dream the show, I feel like.
I don't know. It's like, oh, I do. I haven't told you this yet. I have some news.
Mm. Oh.
We're bringing the show back to Edinburgh. I'm going to be in Edinburgh for the month of August.
Oh, my God. You're mental. You're mental.
I'm absolutely mental. No, it'll be great. It'll be so fun. The thing is we got – it was too good of a deal. We couldn't turn it down, basically. But that being said, I have to tell you this other thing. Is we got asked – so we're doing these podcasts and stuff. So we were in a podcast called Scummy Mummies, which are these two mums in England who are so funny. They're comedians. They're great. So we guested on their show. And then we also guested on Drunk Women Solving Murder – or Drunk Women Solving Crime. And so I talked a little about – Truly, Darkly, Creepily at the end. I was like, but here's what's crazy is what they do. Their whole thing is like one person presents a case and asks a bunch of questions and we have to answer them. And she was like, I'm actually doing this interesting story of Virginia Hill. And I was like, I know the story already.
You're like, uh-oh.
I was like, uh-oh.
I know it backward fucking forward.
Well, you know, I mean, it was interesting because there were moments where she was asking questions and I was like, I actually don't think I know this. I just kept saying horse semen. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was like, if anything else, it was a mafia. Anyway, moral of the story was that's going to be out soon, which should be pretty fun, too. And that was really fun. It was like awesome. They get drunk and talk about crime, which I was like, we do that in like less structured way. And we
do that separate.
We get drunk and talk.
We all together.
Exactly right. By the way. You're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily. That's Quinlan Posner. And I'm Carrie.
That's old Carrie.
Quinn, I've missed you.
We're on a little bit of a delay, I can tell. But you know what?
Ugh.
I like it. If it's going to make people feel like, edge of their seats, what will happen next?
If there is a little delay, I'm going to say grow up. Grow up. Here's why. I am in another country.
Heard of it?
That's incredible.
International travel.
It's insane to me that I'm in another country and we're still talking. This is crazy. This is wild.
This is the future.
This is the future. I believe the children are our future and also video calls. So
I did want to tell you that we have a lot of Patreon subscribers.
I've been seeing.
So we're like behind, which is a really fun thing. We're like way behind.
I know. Hey, so we're thank gonna you continue. So much. For joining Patreon.
You guys.
We're going to continue the incredible tradition of singing.
How many should we do?
How many do we have?
3 an episode? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. But like, I think we should do 3. Because I think we should do 3
We are because, so behind.
Isn't more than that like
rude?
I know, but when we get behind, we feel like, oh my God, we have so many new people. And then we catch up and then we're like, no one to thank this episode. And so I kind of like having a stockpile.
No, I think also people want
a new Patreon subscriber and you're hearing this, just buckle your seatbelt. You're 12th in line, maybe.
Here's the thing. Could you imagine us doing 12 songs? And I think people would turn us off. No. I don't think people want to hear that. I don't think the people I'm sharing this home with want to hear it. Turn me on, you know? Let's do it.
All right, if you thought a delay was weird, wait till you guys hear a delay with an improvised song attached.
We're just going to take long breaks.
Okay.
It's going to be a pause.
How about we thank Bryce?
Bryce.
I hope you don't get lice. I hope you don't get lice because it's not nice. It's not nice. It doesn't feel nice, Bryce.
But Bryce,
you got to roll the dice if you're hanging out with me.
Bryce, you're my vice. You're my lovely flice. You took all the rhymes. You took them all. And I had to wait because we were delayed.
I took them all.
Bryce, you are so nice. Don't get lost. You are my vice because I think about you twice a night. Yes, every night, Bryce. I think about you because that's what I do. I think about you, Bryce.
Ooh, I loved how it got sexy. Okay, that was great. Tracy from outer space.
Tracy, your name isn't Lacey, but you lace up your shoes or maybe you tie them with Velcro. Do you just slide your shoes in like a weirdo? Cause I do that too. Tracy, you are cool.
Tracy, we love a slip-on, but not as much as we love you. Ooh-ah-hoo-hoo.
What is that?
That's like a sound effect to prove a point.
I'm sorry. When you do that, I think, does she have swollen lymph nodes? Do you think by you doing hoo-ha-hoo, that made Griffin have swollen lymph nodes? Like, do you think that you brought that on to your family?
It's definitely my fault.
Well, you're the mother. Of course it's your fault. You brought them into this world. If ever they get sick, it's kind of on you. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, God is watching.
Moms out in the podcast field. How do you feel about me blaming you for children's sickness?
Carrie gets this huge backlash. I'd love to see it.
No,
in the meantime, let's thank Sarah K. What the heckity hey.
Sarah K, you are here today in a song form. Don't get long, dorm. It's a weird rhyme. I can't tell it's not time because I'm out of practice. It's been a month, Sarah K.
We'd love to cook you a filet today.
Ooh.
And then we could go play on the
do it
gay street. You know, they're... I was thinking Gay Street, but it's Gaylord. That's the street I grew up near. Gaylord.
There is a Gay Street.
Would have been hard to be.
There is a Gay Street. I think I've been around it. I don't know, but I've seen it on things. The names here. I have to tell you, being on tour in England, all I want to do is speak in an English accent. It's really fucked.
Tell me more.
It's really fucked. Really fucked. Oh, this is the thing that I got to tell you.
I think it's great.
Okay. Say thank you. Okay. Imagine you're me. We're in another country. We're in England, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's all right.
That's what people say? When you say thank you, they say, it's all right?
That's all right. I go. Wait. Did I hurt you? Are you mad at me? You know me. I'm like, I just think everyone's mad
at me. That's the response? Mm-hmm. No, you're welcomes.
No worries. That's all right. I go, I'm sorry. Did I murder your family? What's going on here? Did I step on
like
your home?
Your thank you's being rejected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
weird. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with it. And I have all this pent up feelings of feeling unfulfilled. And then instead of saying like, if you say hi to someone, they go like this. You all right? You meet someone. You all right?
I think I like it. I actually like it. I'm going to double down and say that I like the non-committal.
It's all right. Everything's like, all right. Okay. But to me, it's the thank you that freaks me out. And it says, thank you so much. Yeah. That's all right. That's all right. And sometimes it's the that's all right. And I go, okay. I guess that's all right, isn't it? Okay.
Wow. Dense.
Yeah. It's an odd episode. So Quinn, you're up.
What?
You're up. It's your turn.
No. Okay, yes. I'll do it.
Okay. Right. Put her in, folks. Put her in, coach.
All right. Let me get my.
By the way, let's
together.
While you're doing that, let's hear from our sponsors. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna tell you that what happened was, I heard this story in a backward, roundabout way, which is to say, somebody sent me something that said, look, this is really interesting. It's true crime, but it's this controversy where a Netflix doc came out, true crime doc, and everybody's like, oh, it looks like they used AI to make the photos, and it's a true crime. So it's like, did they not have enough images of this girl that's featured in it, Jennifer Pan?
I haven't seen this yet, but it's photos. What did Jennifer do? Is it what did Jennifer do?
Yes.
Oh, I'm excited.
It is.
I haven't seen it.
So what's wild is they show pictures of her in this documentary, and when you really like, they do it quickly. Mm-hmm. So you're just like, okay, whatever. But then people started looking closer, and they're pointing out that she has a really unnaturally long tooth in one of the pictures. She's doing one of the peace sign in one of them, and her little finger is all like mangled, and there's a weird palm, like fold in her palm that doesn't make sense. And basically only the fingers that are totally sticking up look real. All the tucked ones like this look alien. And you know how AI can't really do fingers?
No, they can't do fingers or ears.
Right. And her ears fucked up on one of them.
It's
they
always
think.
The ears. Man.
And her nose doesn't look like it has nostrils. Like maybe it's just an angle, but there's all kinds of things. Her shoulder looks like it's like bent out of place. And there's like bizarre little folds in her armpit. Basically, they're like, this doesn't make any sense. This picture looks like it's AI. And there was a huge backlash because that's alarming for a documentary to be using.
Yeah, especially when we're talking
AI
about true
generated
crime.
Photos if you don't have enough photos.
Have you?
Producer Jeremy Grimaldi was like, oh, actually, we were using like photo editing software because we were trying to protect the identity of the person that gave us these photos. I don't know if that means they were trying to AI. Like, basically, replace. Like, try to vanish maybe some people and try to do weird things with the background to make it
people.
Less obvious where
it
they
just
were.
It sounds like Netflix is trying to kill these people.
They just tried to kill everyone
well,
that knew anything about the production
the
is now
privacy,
dead.
Yeah, in order to protect the privacy, we just thought we'd kill them. And that's actually
yes.
easier.
So, and that's the true crime
yeah, and that's, and,
that I'm here to talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Netflix has been vanishing people for a long time, and it's got to stop, and it's stopping here and now. But actually, I am going to now just tell you, because I started digging in from that perspective of just the AI and then was like, maybe I should actually watch the documentary. And I did. And I also read some articles, some Daily Mail.
Some really reputable stuff.
And super.
You know us. We only read the most reputable sources. So that's that.
We only read what we feel like reading after we put our kids to bed.
You know what
so
I do?
Drop
we
it,
only
okay?
read what comes up very early in the Google search. Okay. I can't be bothered to go on a deep dive. I Google a name and what comes up is what it's going to be. So move. If you wanted real journalism.
Some of us have lice shampoo to get to. Jennifer Pan, her mom, Big Hop Hen, and her father. Shoot, I think it's...
We're off to a great start. This is a great start.
They were Chinese refugees from Vietnam. They got married in Toronto, and they're Canadian.
Yay!
They have two kids. Jennifer's the oldest, and then 3 years later, they had a little boy named Felix. And they have... It's a humble sort of life for them. They work at an auto plant. The dad does... tool making, I think, and the wife makes car parts. Anyway, they make enough money that they're like, we can get a home in this predominantly Asian neighborhood that we want to live in. And it like, it's a good home. We're really happy. Like, they just want stability. Mm-hmm. They want to give their kids a better life than they had. They are strict parents. Cut to a 911 call from Jennifer to the police at about 10:30 at night one night, saying that people have broken into their house, stolen money, and that she doesn't know where her parents are. She sounds terrified. It's very alarming listening to this call. And they bring her in. She says that the people had tied her up upstairs. She didn't know where her parents were. She gets questioned by police, and there's footage of it. She's sobbing, and they're like, do the best you can. We're here to help you. What had happened that night is that both of her parents have been shot. Her mother is dead when they arrive, and her father is in the hospital. He's in critical condition. He was shot basically right under the eye, I believe.
Oh, my God.
He's in an induced coma. He's not doing well. And so Jennifer is the only witness to this. And no one understands why this would have happened. They're talking to people. No one would have heard it. No one would have heard them, I was going to say. No one would have hurt these people. They really did not have any enemies. And I think I just outlined why they might have been, like, not a great target for a robbery.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like they were sitting on a box of jewels. There wasn't a ton to gain.
Yeah.
They are interviewing Jennifer, and she's explaining that her mom had gone to line dancing. They had dinner. Her mom got home at 9:30 at night, and this people broke in. She describes one of them as black with dreadlocks, and they restrained them and asked, where's your money? They dragged her mother downstairs and were asking, where's her purse? They tied Jennifer to a banister, and that Jennifer could hear her parents and you know, screaming in the other room, and these guys saying, you lied to us. And then she heard two pops and her mother scream, and then more pops. So, yeah, she's saying that there was three men, two of them at least were black. One of them had a Jamaican accent. We're dealing with hoodies. And this is a very safe neighborhood, so this crime, when it is reported, it's all over the news.
Right. Well, in Canada, I don't think that, I mean, obviously there are guns up there, but like in terms of gun violence, I mean, that's just not, I don't think, a pretty common thing up there.
No, I don't think so either. And especially not in this neighborhood. There was not really any crime to speak of. They have a video of the front of the street that confirms Jennifer's account, which is just to say it's a very grainy video at night. You can see that three people enter the house. That's what see. But there doesn't appear to have been forced entry. They're just walking in. So they did just walk in the front door, which, you know, could happen. Again, I was just sort of explaining that it's a safe neighborhood. They start to canvass for information, and there is a man named Danny Wong who they get an indication they should speak to. He is a drug dealer. I don't think it's like a serious, I think it's like weed.
Right.
But he had been in a relationship with Jennifer. He's her ex. And meanwhile, when they're questioning Jennifer, they're like, was anybody like threatening your family, your mother, your father, you? And she's like, well, my ex, Danny, his new girlfriend has been threatening me and has like said mean things to me over Facebook, over text. And then they're like, Danny, I wish you would have told us about him before. Kind of weird you left him out, but we figured out that you guys used to date. Sounds like he maybe dealt drugs. Maybe it was a drug thing. Let's bring Danny in. Let's question Danny. And they start to unfold this story that is that basically they broke up because of her parents, which is to say her parents had this really, really tight leash on her. They expected a lot from her. And then when they found out that she was dating Danny and that he worked at a pizza place and was a drug dealer, they were like, no, he's not good enough for you. We don't like this for you.
I wouldn't have led with that. I wouldn't have led with that. Hey, meet my boyfriend. He's a drug dealer. I just don't think that's probably like you wouldn't lead with that.
It's a really good question. I'm not totally sure how the parents knew about that, but they did know he was bad news and they were like, you can't see that guy. And they imposed really strict guidelines on when she could go out and who she could go out with. So she couldn't go out with him. She was going out with him. They were sneaking around a bunch, but there's only so much sneaking you can do.
Right.
So I think he got a little fed up. They ended up breaking up. He ended up in this new relationship. And I think that was really hard for Jennifer because she really still cared about him and wished she was with him. You know, people that were friends with him were talking about how she saved all her money to buy him a paint gun for his birthday. And it was like thousands of dollars, which I'm like, why is a paint gun that much money? And who needs a paint gun?
Who needs a paint gun? I'd rather, you know what though? I'd rather give someone a paint gun than a real gun. So I'll stand by that. That you can quote me on that.
I will. So her parents want her to be a pharmacist. They're really serious about her doing well in school. She once told her piano teacher, which again, like she has to play piano. They're very pushy about things like that. And she told her piano teacher she felt really overwhelmed by how protective they were.
She's a first generation kid in Canada. And it sounds like her parents like are just wanting her to do well. Like it sounds like they're putting a lot of pressure on their kids to succeed, and that of course that would be overwhelming. Of course that would be hard.
Yeah, and there's just ends up being a disconnect there where she feels all this pressure and she's not doing that well in school and she's telling them that she is. So she ends up getting on Photoshop and, you know, making fake report cards that say she got A's when she's actually not getting A's. And she actually failed calculus when she was a senior and they didn't know that. And when that happened, the school she got into rescinded her early admission.
No.
She doesn't want to tell her parents that that happened. So she's like, I'm going there. Like I am going to school.
Oh, no.
And she acts like she's going to school and will just leave her house and go sit at a cafe or probably presumably at the time see her boyfriend or something that she's not supposed to be doing, but basically use that time to be alone and do something else and then come home and be like, here's my fake. Like she bought like textbooks and things. Like she did all these things to make it look like she's
going to school. It's going to blow up. It's going to blow up.
And they're like, wait, where's like the money we owe for the school, like the bills? And she's like, I got it. I got all these scholarships. Like I'm really good at what I'm doing. And in fact, I'm in the pharmacology program, just like you always wanted at University of Toronto. And I'm like doing all these things. She's even kind of learning pharmacology so that she can make class notes.
It was like a Breaking Bad situation. She's learning pharmacology.
No, it was
so
like.
She has to actually like look like she's learning
she has to
something.
Have props.
Yeah.
Yeah. She has to have like props that make it look like she is doing these things. But she's 24. She's 24 when her parents get killed. And she, at the age of 22, I remember reading that she had never gone to a club or been drunk or gone to a friend's house without her family. She just felt really oppressed by this upbringing because that is, you know, I think when you picture that, oh, her parents are doing this, she's 16, 17, 18, and then you're like, oh, she's in her
20s.
That's different. And she's supposedly at a university and lying to her parents about it. She's like living at home like a kid. They're imposing all these strict rules like she's a kid, and it's not.
I don't know.
It's an unhealthy situation for everyone involved.
Yeah.
She told her parents that she started volunteering at the Hospital for Sick Children, which is the name of it. I was like, that is a really
straightforward
name. I think
I've passed it in Toronto.
Name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. I was like, what a straightforward
it's,
name.
It's a cra- it's like literally, it's just a hospital for sick children. You like walk by it and that's
just
what
like,
it says.
they between themselves must be talking, the parents, because they're like, yeah, but like, where's her hospital badge? And like, where's her uniform? She just like leaves in jeans and a shirt and she says that's where she's going. Seems kind of weird. And the mom is like, I'm going to follow her. So she follows her to work. And then I'm sure she just went to a cafe or something. I don't know the details, but I know she figures out that her daughter's been lying to her. And the dad is like, let's fucking throw her out on her ass. She's been lying to us. And the mom's like, no, let her stay. And she starts to try to work to finish high school because she didn't finish high school because of failing that calculus course. And I think at that point, her parents are like, you have another chance here to do what's right.
Yeah.
And the sticking point is Danny. And Jennifer will tell the police when she's recounting these things that it was an ethnic thing why they didn't want her to go out with Danny Wong. And that just doesn't seem to be true. It seems like when you talk to the people, the parents knew that it had to do with him being a bad influence and being a drug dealer. She does get caught talking to him and they're basically like, now you can't be trusted at all. And they drive her from place to place. They don't even let her go out on her own. She's 24 at this point.
Right.
So I kind of am going back and forth, so I hope it's not confusing. But as you guys know, once they really had broken up, Danny did start to see this other woman, the one that Jennifer was insinuating had made some threats. Once he starts dating this other woman, Jennifer tells him that a bunch of guys broke into her house, like basically showed her a police badge and she thought they were police. She let them in and they gang raped her. And then she also says that she got a bullet mailed to her. And she also says, I think your new girlfriend is the one behind all this stuff, which totally reminds me of that case.
Ruth
the Craigslist one.
Oh, yeah.
No, the Craigslist one where the girl was like, your new girlfriend or your ex-girlfriend is doing all these things to me, but it wasn't.
It was just her.
It's like very like obvious that
it's a cry for attention.
This new girlfriend is not trying, did not send rapists to your house.
No.
Like, relax. That didn't happen. Also, he and Jennifer, Danny and Jennifer are getting harassing phone calls and like creepy text messages that say things like, we're watching you. And again, it does feel like Jennifer's the one behind them, not the new girlfriend. She's just like trying to keep Danny in her life. She's trying to align him with her and not the new girlfriend so that their relationship would continue. The last text that he got before the murder happened said bang, bang, bang from this like blocked number. So everyone's like, oh, okay. There's a narrative being woven a little bit that it's the ex-girlfriend maybe. Now, Jennifer up until this point has been the only witness, but her dad is alive and he comes out of the coma and he's able to remember this night. And he's yes, my wife was line dancing. Yes, Jennifer was at home. I was actually asleep. I woke up and there was a guy with a gun who made me go downstairs. My wife was hysterical, screaming that we didn't have any money. I got pistol whipped. And my wife was just begging for her life. And while this was all happening, Jennifer walked downstairs with one of the men and was just like talking to him, like was just talking to him. It was casual. So they're like, keep Jennifer away from her dad. Don't let her visit the hospital. She can't be alone with him for his safety.
Yeah, she'll kill him.
And the reason the documentary is called what it's called is that the dad says, I want you to use your police techniques. You have to find out what Jennifer did. Like, he's right away.
The fact that he remembers that after being shot in the face. Holy shit.
So they bring Jennifer back in, and this time they're, like, watching her through two-way glass, and the guy that's interrogating her is named Bill Gates, which is funny.
Which is just
undeniably.
Great.
Oh, did I mention she lives on Avenue Street? Also sort of a fun fact.
This fun is
confusing.
Gay Street, but...
Yes, Gaylord. So Bill Gates, he's good. He's like, hey, talk to me about how you, like, forged all this stuff to trick your parents. And, oh, you must have felt really limited. Did it ever make you do anything weird? And she's like, yeah, I cut myself. And he's like, oh, what was the deal with Daniel? It seems like you really cared about him. And she's like, yeah, he was filling a void within me. He was like a missing piece. One thing that I didn't know is that in Canada, policemen are allowed to lie to you. So he's like, I'm not a homicide detective. I'm actually a truth-telling expert. And that's why I'm here. I am really good at figuring out if people are telling the truth. And by the way, did you know that we have cameras all over the place that create like a map of the city and show us people's positions? So if we look at the map of your house that night, it's kind of like X-ray vision. We can tell where everyone was in the house. Is that going to like line up with what you told us? Because they were weirded out that she was like, my hands were tied behind my back. And they're like, how are you on the phone with 911? And she's like, I just pulled the phone out of my back pocket and dialed it. And he like they like make her show how they how she did that when she's at the police. It's not chill. So things feel off for a lot of reasons. But obviously the dad's story is what makes them be like, what happened? So he's just going at it eventually with her, like he builds to it. But then he's like, tell me what happened. Tell me what happened. I know that you were involved in this. And he's just pushing and pushing till finally she's like, okay. But what was supposed to happen is they were supposed to kill me. I was behind it, but I was basically a hit on myself and it went wrong. I was suicidal because I was this big disappointment and I had lied to everyone. And I gave like $2,000 to these people to kidnap me and kill me. And he's like, well, what was their name? And she's like, his name was Homie or Homeboy. And you're like, that's not his name, but okay.
Well, so they get a warrant for the phone. That's what's true, is you paid them, but then you're describing them in detail to the police. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Well, and they weren't black with dreads, which is also
not exactly. Great.
We don't love it, Jennifer.
There's a lot of things we don't love about this. Just let the record show.
Let the record show. We're not on board. They get a warrant for her phone, and there's all these texts between she and Homeboy talking about this in a way where it's like very planned, to a point where he's like, what about tonight? And she's like, tonight won't work. We have dinner plans. And oh, he says, God, like, it's go time or show time or something. Yeah. Like, she's like, been planning this for a long time. What's creepy that I didn't see coming when I watched the doc was that Danny is totally part of it. So I thought Danny was just like the innocent ex-boyfriend that was like, she's crazy. You know what I mean? But actually, there's texts that are like, do you care about me? I care about you, from her to Danny. And he's like, I care about you, but like, I care about this new person I'm dating. That's how I feel about her the way you feel about me. And she's like, oh, well, then call it off with Homeboy. And he's like, why? I thought you wanted this whether you were with me or not. But you're like, wait, you're totally part of this, Danny. And he says in the text, I did everything and lined it all up for you. Ooh, so you're like, okay, why is that in Danny text? Really people, was part of
why
this.
Why are people saying that in texts? I mean, I'm glad they did, so we have all the information, but like, guys, come on, do better.
By figuring out who this Homeboy person is, they figure out who everyone is, and it's Lenford Crawford is Homeboy's real name, and the guys that were with him that night are Eric Carty and David Mivagnum. And Jennifer was obviously not telling the truth and was behind this whole plan. And the whole plan was to have her parents murdered. Her diary shows just a clear obsession with Daniel and that everything she was doing was to be with him. She also had approached a friend 10 months before any of this happened and offered him money to kill her parents. So this is something that has been in her head for a long time. And there have been so many times, you know, like when you do something stupid as a kid.
Yeah.
Like get your parents murdered. It's the idea that we've had a lot of true crime stories where a kid gets in over their head and does one stupid. It just what I think bothers me about the 10 months and about the text with Homeboy are this is so. Is that
she had time. She had time to stay. No, she had time. Like this was so long.
And every day she's waking up and saying, yes, this is what I want. Yeah. I definitely want to have my parents killed. And then she's taking steps to ensure that it happens. And when it doesn't work, she doesn't change course. She's just like, no, for sure, that's what I want. And her mother's last words, No. Were "Don't hurt my daughter" to the people killing her. It's devastating.
Oh.
The trial is 10 months. They all plead not guilty to the charges of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. And they have all the evidence is like cell phone stuff, all the messages between them. Because Jennifer will just keep saying like that she wasn't part of the plan, but it's very irregular to leave a witness that way, like to kill those people. And she was not blindfolded. She was not harmed in any way. She was not taken to they just left her to be an eyewitness. She does end up being convicted and they all get sentenced, pretty much everyone involved, including her and Daniel Wong, to 25 or life with no parole for 25 years. Her dad also has a lifetime no contact order against her, which of course he does.
But of course he does. So fucking sad. So sad. That feels so sad. Mm-hmm. Ugh.
And another really interesting thing is that I read that in May of 2023, the Court of Appeals in Ontario granted an appeal by her and everybody involved that ruled that the trial judge had incorrectly instructed the jury to only consider two scenarios that would justify a first-degree murder charge, but they didn't allow them to consider any scenarios that would have led to a second-degree murder charge or manslaughter charges. So they might get a new trial based on that.
Okay, so they could take her down from first-degree. It just feels like she's so premeditated. It's all premeditated. I know. It's all so sad.
It's so sad. And the other thing that was kind of crazy that happened in the wake of all this is that the media also created these stories that were like, this is tiger parenting gone wrong, yeah. Which is a crazy victim blaming thing to do.
Totally. Because
if you are 24 and you decide to live at home with your parents, then guess what? Their roof, their rules. And if you don't like it, you're 24 years old.
Get the fuck out.
Move out. Don't kill them, you fucking lunatic.
It's so hard too, because culturally too, right? It's like these are people that gave up their whole life and moved to a new country to make it better. Like, what happened to her younger brother, Felix?
I don't know. I didn't really find anything about him. I think probably his identity is protected, and I don't know. Yeah. I hope he has peace. What, another sad victim.
Totally, totally. This is a crime that has many, many victims. That's really sad. And I mean, like, of course her father has a no contact, but like, he's lost his wife. He's lost his daughter. It's just, ugh, that's so sad. That's so sad. The appeals thing, they could go down, but I mean, she's guilty as the day is long. I mean, they have all the texts. Mm-hmm. Like, what, in what world is she going to get off? Hey, let's hear from our sponsors. Okay, the case that I'm going to cover, I actually got from one of our dearest readers, Todd Parkman.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
He sent a Texas Monthly article, and I said, well, nail in the coffin, we're covering it. We're doing it, because I love Texas Monthly.
Before I forget, I did just want to tell you something really quickly before you start a story. That is, one of our listeners, David, told me the craziest thing. It's going to make you so happy.
What?
Do you remember Donna McLean? She was the one that was raped by deception.
Yes.
He sent her, or like added her in something. I don't know how, like, online stuff works at all, and I think it involved Twitter, so I especially don't know. But he said that she listened.
Wait, didn't I cover that case?
And that, yes, he said that she listened, and that she said it made the hairs on her neck stand up. I felt like truly like a famous person like liked us or something, because I was like, oh my god, it just, that's so crazy.
It means a lot when it just means a lot when someone who's like feels like we've taken care of their story in a way, because that was a maddening story. That one stayed with me. That one still stays.
Oh my god, I told him that. I told him that my sister, that Brianna, was like, you do a lot of scary stories. That's the one that gave me nightmares. That is so freaky.
It's so fucked.
Anyway,
it's a, thank you.
I just
for
thought that was really exciting.
And
I don't think she's like a diehard fan listening right now,
no,
but she did.
I don't
listen.
Think she's
her,
listening. I think she's dealt with enough trauma in her life where she doesn't. Have
well,
to listen
she did
anymore.
Listen to your coverage, and it did seem like she did not give you a bad review. So,
ugh,
you have a fan.
Blessings,
and thank you for telling us.
I'm
David.
Her fan. Yeah, thank you for telling us, David. Okay.
So this information
from Todd Parkman, Texas Monthly, Wikipedia, Daily Beast, New York Post. And this involves sports, which, you know, that's not my
sports.
Bag. It's not my bag. Sports. I'm going to take you to Texas, to Baylor. It's the summer 2003. We're in Texas. And I'm going to introduce you to two basketball players. One is named Patrick Dennehy, and the other is Carl. And the other is Carlton. The two of these men are, I mean, are they men? They're like in their early 20s. They're men. Two of these men have recently transferred to Baylor in the hopes. What was that laugh for?
That 20-year-olds were not men, but I knew if it had been women, you would not have called them girls. You would have called them women and not had a pause. But then you were like, are they men? They're 20. It's just like, I just liked that you
but
were
I
like,
say,
meh,
I would say
men.
Well, okay, they're men. Yeah, they're men. They're men. They're men in tights. Okay, no, they're men in basketball shorts. So they're these two basketball players, and they were recently transferred to Baylor to help invigorate their basketball program. And these guys, like, they're good at sports. I'm sure, you know, they're just good at sports. I don't know what to tell you. Dennehy, Patrick Dennehy, is 6'10". He's from California. He's described as driven. He's funny. He's kind. His mom and stepdad said basically, like, he picked up a basketball and, like, was playing that day. Like, he just was a natural, gifted, talented athlete. And these two men, Patrick and Carlton, they become their teammates, obviously, but they become best friends and roommates, and they're buddies. They're really close. So it's the summer of 2003, and Dennehy and Patrick and Carlton start to tell their friends that they are worried for their safety. They say they make reports. I don't know how formal these reports were, but I know people were hearing that there was something going on. Mm. They were worried about their safety. So what they did, we're in Texas, okay, they go and they buy handguns and a rifle for self-defense. And the two of them, they would go to a shooting range, and they would, like, a farm north of Waco, Texas, and they would practice shooting these guns. Patrick's family recalls him calling them, being like, I'm worried about this teammate, Harvey Thomas, who is apparently making threats against him. And this is all, again, hearsay. Like, these are all reports that people will say later. So it's June 14th, 2003, and Patrick calls his friends, and he's like, I'm a little bit worried about my safety, but I think I should be okay. He also says that him and Carlton are going to go to a party together the following day. Let it be known that the following day, neither one of them show up. Patrick Dennehy is last seen on June 14th, 2003. Obviously, it takes a minute for people to realize that he's missing. So Patrick's mom and stepdad don't hear from him for a couple of days. He misses Father's Day, which feels like a bit of a red flag for him. It was very unlike him. Patrick's other roommate comes home from being out of town, and he notices that Patrick's dogs haven't been fed for a couple of days. It isn't until June 19th that Patrick's mom and stepdad file a missing persons report. On June 25th, they find his car in a parking lot in Virginia Beach, Virginia, which is far away from Texas. The license plates have been removed. So it seems like they've tried to scrub this car and get it as far away from Texas as possible. There is an affidavit that was filed June 23rd that isn't unsealed until June 30th. And it says that in a search warrant for Patrick's computer, an informant tells the police that Carlton, his best friend, who is currently at home in Maryland, had told his cousin that he shot and killed Patrick during an argument while they were firing guns in Waco. So just to be clear, Patrick and his friend, Carlton, bought these guns for self-defense. They were worried about their safety from other teammates. According to this affidavit, this cousin of Carlton says that he admitted to killing Patrick at this farm in Waco, Texas. July 21st,
Carlton calls the police and he confesses to shooting Patrick himself and is charged with murder and taken into custody in Maryland. It's also important to know that they do not have a body yet. They don't know what happened, mm-hmm. which is, I think, is that like month separation between when they first get that affidavit or that couple, that 3 week difference. Is like they have this information, but they don't have a body and they're trying to find him. It is 4 days after Carlton is charged that they find the body of Patrick Dennehy in a gravel pit near Waco, Texas, which aligns with they were at this farm and Carlton shot him. July 30th, they perform an autopsy. His death is ruled as a homicide. There are reports that his head and his body were found separately. And so there were rumors of decapitation, but what they are attributing it to is some scavenging desert animals after basically a month decomposing. So it seems like an open and shut case, right? It's like Carlton murders his friend, Patrick. Now, what's interesting about Carlton is that he is preparing to go to trial and he is evaluated to make sure that he is psychologically competent to withstand trial, right? Three psychiatrists, including one court-appointed psychiatrist, say that Carlton suffers from hallucinations and psychosis. When he is charged, it is very quick that they realize that he is not competent to stand trial. And so they say that he can regain competency, but they're going to have to hold out. So he goes into a mental hospital and the plan is to be reevaluated in 4 months. Based on what I read is that Carlton believes that he was Jesus and he was hearing voices and he believed that people were out to kill him. Again, we don't know all of the specifics, but it appears that maybe that would have been his motive to kill Patrick, where he believed Patrick was trying to kill him, so he kills Patrick. Carlton's ex-wife also corroborates that she notices that he has been hearing voices, and it's February of 2005, and he is finally declared competent, so he can return to jail as long as he takes his antipsychotic medications. Right. So I think, I mean, just reading this in my pea-sized brain for criminal justice, it does seem a little bit difficult for him to get not a fair trial, but it seems like this person is clearly mentally ill. And how much, I mean, obviously he is guilty. He's admitted guilt to it, all that stuff. But what are the court proceedings, right? What does justice look like in this situation? So he's finally declared competent as long as he's on his antipsychotic medication. And just as an anecdote, there's another psychologist that says that Carlton's accounts of hearing voices might be suspect. But that's just one psychologist or psychiatrist. It seems like the majority of the people that interviewed him, evaluated him, were like, he's not well and he couldn't, you know, stand trial. Okay. The trial is supposed to begin the middle of June 2005, a year and a half after, or almost nearly 2 years after Patrick was found dead, after Patrick disappeared. 5 days before the trial begins, Carlton Dotson pleads guilty. He does not go to trial. June 15th of that year, he is sentenced to 35 years in prison. December, so about 6 months later, he writes a letter asking to appeal the case. That January, a judge rules that he forfeited his right to appeal when he pled guilty. So this guy is in jail. He is denied parole December 2020, December 2021, February 2022, February 2023, and March 2024, just a couple of months ago.
It'd be so crazy if that was like a 10-year thing and you just did each month.
It's like, wild.
I wasn't totally paying attention but I was like anxious. I was like, how many times is she going to say this?
How many times is she going to say it? Okay, like, you know what? Let me say it easier. 1, 2, 3, 4. He was denied parole four times.
Okay, got it.
Now I can breathe. This year, March 2024, he was approved for parole with the completion of a program prior to release. Okay. So
While that's the criminal case, and it seems sort of cut and dry, although I will say from my perspective, him pleading guilty 5 days before the trial where he could have possibly pled not guilty by reason of insanity, you know, he could have maybe asked for a lesser sentence. He was sentenced to 35 years in prison. That's pretty much the clear-cut case, right? But here's where the Texas Monthly article comes in. Here's where the Todd Parkman pitch came in, is that this case activated a huge controversy within Baylor University for the handling and the scandal of this horrible crime, this horrible tragedy, and it involves the coaches of the basketball team.
Whoa.
The coach of Baylor's basketball team is this guy, Dave Bliss, and he was hired to reinvigorate the Baylor basketball program. And it's giving me, like, I know it's a different sport, but like Friday Night Lights, it's like basketball is life. And it's like the Final Four, the NCAA. Having a good basketball program obviously is a huge get for university. And it's the South, so I just think everything is just like fucking crazy. So Dave Bliss is hired to invigorate this basketball program. Patrick and Carlton were the ones that were transferred into the program, right? They were like kind of be the saving grace in a lot of ways. What's important to note is that 5 days after Patrick's body was found dead, we have recordings of what the coach is saying to the team and his assistant coach. We have these recordings because his assistant coach, Abar Roos, I'm not sure how you say his first name, but Abar Roos got a $25 tape recorder and he wired himself and he recorded the conversations he had with this coach, Dave Bliss. I'm going to give you some quotes just so you can kind of place yourself in this situation. He says, "We can get out of this. There's nobody right now that can say that we paid Pat Dennehy because he's dead." Obviously, when Patrick goes missing, they're looking through his computers. They're looking at his financials. They're like, did he disappear? Did he leave on his own volition? There's a lot to be learned, obviously, from bank account statements. What's important to know is that it is illegal. It is a big no-no, bad news bears for any coach to pay money for a player to play on their team, right? The NCAA, you cannot give monetary compensation to your players.
Okay.
What they will find is that Patrick Dennehy's tuition is paid for, as well as the down payment for his car by his
coach.
So
they're not giving him directly. They're just like being like, well, we're not going to give it to you. We're going to give it to the car guy. We're going to give it to your landlord.
Exactly.
What a workaround.
So it's no bueno. They're recording Dave Bliss and he's saying things like, we can get out of this, you know, he's dead. He's almost like, we can say whatever we want because he's dead. In order to try to save his own ass, David Bliss starts a smear campaign against the deceased Patrick Dennehy. He starts making accusations that Patrick is a drug dealer. And like I think it goes without saying the racist, horrible implications there are to state that, to have that out in the world. Bliss is also caught on a recording asking the fellow players on the team to slander Patrick's name after he died. Thankfully, again, I just have to give a shout out to this assistant coach who is recording him. Here's some more quotes. "It doesn't have to be the same story. It just has to have the same ending. What we have to do is create reasonable doubt. Dennehy is never going to refute what we say. If we say something about him, he's dead, so he isn't going to argue with me at all."
Oh, God. What a monster.
Truly disgusting. This is a person who courted this young man to play for his team. And as soon as he caught, as soon as David Bliss was going to get caught with his pants down, it was like every man for himself, jump ship. And this poor kid who is dead is now going to be slandered and he can't defend himself, his poor family, his poor friends, his poor everybody who knows him. When the assistant, I had mentioned the name Harvey Thomas, right? Harvey Thomas was someone who Patrick had told family and friends that he was getting threats from this guy. And so when the assistant coach, Roos, asks Bliss if he thinks one of the players, Harvey Thomas, will go along with this plan, Bliss says, "Fuck yeah, Harvey will throw himself on the grenade. That fucker will lie when the truth's easier. He'll do anything. And the reason is because we did it for Harvey, you know? I mean, we stuck up for him. That's why we're in this jam. If we stuck up for Harvey, okay? I said there's no threats." What's important is there was a documentary that came out, I believe, in 2017. It's on Showtime. It's called Disgraced, and it talks about this scandal. And the documentary calls into question the guilty plea of Carlton Dotson, like I mentioned. Mm. What's important to note is that Carlton's attorneys, I believe, were paid for by Baylor. They were university lawyers who were defending him. And again, this is the guy who went, who pled guilty 5 days before his trial. And all of this stuff could have been used as motive, as reason. All of that stuff could have come out in the trial. So there is reason to believe possibly that the university had a vested interest in keeping this case quick. Yes. Or even if Carlton did do it and he did call and turn himself in, but even if he did do it, was justice served in that way? And was he defended to the best of anyone's ability? Or were they just defending the university? Filmmakers from the documentary Disgraced also call into question whether Harvey Thomas might have been involved more so in the murder. And that's all conjecture. I don't have any evidence that's going to support that, except that we know that Patrick said he was worried about his safety or he received threats from Thomas. Thomas denies this and says that he never threatened Patrick Dennehy. So what happened from this scandal? Well, Dave Bliss, the coach, was banned from the NCAA for a whopping 10 years for violations related to Dennehy's recruitment, the murder, and the cover-up. He resigned as coach, but again, he was banned for 10 years. But just as a note, he was also involved in a 1987 scandal at Southern Methodist University, which involved basketball players getting paid. So this is like not new. It seems like these workarounds happen often. But Bliss, this coach, he just sounds like a fucking piece of shit. I'm just going to say it. He releases a book called Fall to Grace. And at this point, so after a 10-year ban, okay, don't worry, he's back. He's the head basketball coach for Southwestern Christian University in Oklahoma. And in the documentary, they like interview him, okay? And so he's a subject in this documentary. And what's fucking crazy, Quinn, is he is still perpetuating the lie that Patrick Dennehy was using drugs and was a drug dealer. He believes he's not recorded in this documentary, but they had a hot mic. Hello, we saw the jinx. We know how this works. And he says, this is off camera, but he was selling drugs. He sold to all the white guys on campus. Yeah, he was the worst, but you'll never be able to use this. And then he says, on the record, a question that a man always has to ask himself when he goes through something like I went through, are you in a better spot than you were before? Was it worth it? Hmm. And the answer to me is yes. This is a man.
So he's learning a lot of lessons.
No fucking conscience.
No.
It is wild to me. It is wild. There is a person who is dead. There is a family that have lost. And you're going to continually slander his name. Patrick's stepfather has said something because his family denies it all, right? His family's like, he was not a drug dealer. There's no evidence to support this. It's such lie. It's libelous slander. And his stepfather is like, I've never met the man. I don't know how old he is. But if I saw him, I'd punch his teeth in. And frankly, I get it. So the like saving grace knuckles of this story is this assistant coach. Seriously. The saving grace of this story is this assistant coach, Abar Roos, right, who like took a risk, tape recorded, the head coach put his career at risk. And I just want to give you an update of where he is. He is employed as a teacher in federal prison, and he has never been rehired as a coach. I just want to, and I'm going to end, it's just like, again, it's like the sanctity of the sports. It's like it feels like he... By recording this conversation, by recording this
Everyone
coach,
was like, well, we don't want to work with that guy.
Crazy scandal. Exactly.
Snitches get stitches.
The guy with fucking heart Exactly. But I'm going to leave this story with a quote from the assistant coach, Roos, who thankfully recorded Bliss. So this scandal popped open. But here's what he says. He says, "I love what I do and I'm proud of what I do. If I was coaching, could I say the same thing? Coach Bliss has said that he is sorry and he deserves a second chance and has asked for redemption. I can't buy into it. I can't believe. It's not because I don't believe in redemption or second chances. It's because I work with criminals on a constant basis. I know what fake redemption looks like and what real redemption looks like."
Amen.
And that's the story of the poor death of Patrick Dennehy and the scandal surrounding Baylor in Texas.
Let the guy rest in peace.
It's so sick, right? It's just so sad. It's
so sad. Well, it's good to see you. It's horrible to hear your story. And I think we should go because guess what? We have a Patreon episode to record. It's going to be really fun. You're not going to get bored. I've got more stories to tell you about Disneyland. A lady like you will understand.
Did you just write that?
Yes.
Wow.
It was better than all the Patreon songs, but why?
It was 1,000% better than all the other Patreon songs. And if that doesn't lure you to Patreon, I don't know what does. Hey, we'll see you next week. We love you. We miss you. We're so happy we're here. Okay, goodbye.